HPR News.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Almost a month after Egypt's first real presidential election, the country's new leader, Mohamed Morsi, said this week that negotiations on forming a new cabinet are ongoing. Right after his election in late June, Morsi proclaimed he'd be a president for all Egyptians and that he'd appoint a cabinet which reflects that. Still, Mr. Morsi's background as a member of the Islamist group, the Muslim Brotherhood, has generated nervousness among secular and Christian groups in Egypt. Also, the Egyptian military remains strongly in control. In fact, on the eve of the presidential vote, it pushed through constitutional amendments, ensuring its power would remain. Still, it's hard to overstate the significance of this presidential election, part of a political transition our guest today says was unthinkable less than 2 years ago. We're talking this hour with Jeannie Sowers, a UNH Associate Professor of Political Science who focuses on the Middle East, especially Egypt. Sowers has just co-edited a new book called The Journey to Tahrir. It's a collection of essays examining the social, economic, and political trends that underpin the Egyptian uprising, events that occurred below the radar for most of us, but played a part in the surprisingly powerful protest movement that captivated the world and toppled a dictator. Today in The Exchange, understanding the uprising in Egypt and what the country faces now, let's hear from you. If you're of Egyptian descent or travel there often, what are your hopes and fears for that nation? Do recent events in Egypt make you optimistic about the country's future or concerned? Give us a call, The Exchange number 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email us at exchange@nhpr.org or post your comments on our Facebook page. And Jeannie Sowers, it's nice to see you. Welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, the book is called Journey to Tahrir with the subtitle Revolution, Protest, and Social Change in Egypt. And there's my question, Jeannie. Has Egypt really undergone a revolution, or is the jury still out on how much has truly changed?
Mm-hmm. That's an excellent question, and I think, like most excellent questions, it's actually yes and no. So it hasn't been a revolution in the way we often think of a fundamental restructuring of the political order. It's just getting underway in Egypt. The military, as you said, is still in control in many ways, and we still have sort of the economic elite in place. There's been no overturning of sort of the big business groups, which we often think happens in a revolution. And there's been no real restructuring of sort of fundamental state institutions yet, except for the presidency and the constitution, which are leading into why it is a revolution, which is that political transformation, I think, is irrevocable. It is sort of underway, this rewriting of the fundamental rules governing the state and the society. The other way it is a revolution is in people's ordinary expectations. So what we see in Egypt, and when you go and talk to people, people feel that for the first time in their lifetime, since the same regime has been in power since the 1950s, is that what they do and say matters in public life. And that's a new experience for many, many Egyptians.
Yeah. Talk about the expectations a little bit more, because it seems like now some of the voices we hear from Egypt are disappointed. They expected more at this point in time.
Yes, I think people expect rapid political and social change. And the fact of the matter is it's going to take a longer time to fix the Egyptian economy, especially fix unemployment, especially among youth, than the revolutionaries and the activists would like. I think that's sort of normal. But I think what is different is that this experience of sort of for so many people participating in street protests and participating in this kind of public engagement has now changed Egyptian politics. So that when I was there last summer or when I talked to my friends, what comes up is that people are willing to do it all again. So workers are still going on strike. Nubians are trying to reclaim land where they were displaced for the creation of the Aswan High Dam. There's protests in Sinai over the detention of their relatives by the security forces. So people are out claiming a part of the political space. And that is profoundly new for most Egyptians.
Well, you do have friends and colleagues, as you said, who are Egyptians living here mm-hmm. in New Hampshire, but you also have friends and colleagues living over there. What are you hearing, Jeannie, from them?
Well, I think many here are very worried about what will happen to their extended families and their friends, particularly if they're in the Coptic minority population, which
those are the Christians.
The Coptic Christians. It's about 10% of the Egyptian population. I would say in Egypt, there's a huge amount of concern about the uncertainty and the sort of protractedness of this political transition. And also the economic situation is very, very dire. So unemployment is very high and people are desperate for tourists to come back, as an example.
Well, and we'll definitely talk about the economics in a few minutes because it's not how it looks on paper.
Right.
You know, but a couple more political questions for you, Jeannie. You know, the elections a few weeks back in late June made great TV. But the military, from what I understand, really kind of holds the keys still.
Yes and no. So we tend to think about the political scene as somehow the presidency, now held by a member of the Muslim Brotherhood, and the military. But what's fascinating about Egypt is that unlike some other Middle Eastern regimes, like Libya, where there were no state institutions left, it seems that way, here we have a lot of other institutions. And some of the most important ones, as we've seen, are the courts. So it was the judiciary that actually said the currently elected parliament is unconstitutional. It's the judiciary that actually has been issuing these decrees saying which laws can be sort of applied and which laws can't. And there's many other political groups in Egypt that are kind of in this contest. There's political parties, there's labor unions, there's business associations. So while we start to see it as a two sort of person game, it's really not. It's actually much more fluid and much more complex.
So that analysis of it's the new president and it's the military, you're saying there's a lot more going on than just that.
Yes, and both those are appealing to law. So both of those are saying the changes we want to make are according to a set of rules, namely laid out in Egyptian law. And that's very, very different than Syria. It's very different than Yemen, where really there's no sense that you have a system of laws and institutions in place that's sort of setting the parameters. And that's why I'm actually optimistic about where Egypt is going. They're rewriting the laws, but no one's throwing them away.
Our phone number here in the exchange for you to join us with your questions or comments is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Our guest is Jeannie Sowers, Associate Professor of Political Science at UNH, co-editor of The Journey to Tahrir, Revolution, Protest, and Social Change in Egypt. Let's hear from you. Do recent events in Egypt make you hopeful about the country's future, or are you skeptical that real change has occurred? Also, if you're from Egypt or travel there often, we'd love to hear from you, your hopes and fears for that nation. Our number is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. You can email us at exchange@nhpr.org or post your comments on our Facebook page. And Jeannie, there's so much in this book that goes beyond those amazing, tumultuous days in Tahrir Square that we were all watching. But let's start there, the uprising that began in early 2011. What really happened to spark this off? I mean, was there sort of one event that was the match that made the fire go?
Well, there are various catalysts that people identify. And one of those, of course, was the murder of this young man, Khaled Said, in Alexandria in the summer of 2010. But I think that what the book chronicles is this escalating, intensifying pattern of protest during the 2000s and across all segments of society. And what several of our authors argue is that those sectors started recognizing that they had interests in common. And they also learned how to deal with the security forces. So whereas the Mubarak regime had perfected techniques of isolating and repressing small demonstrations, what different people learned in a decade of different kinds of protest is that you could overcome that by simultaneous mass protest. And so we actually have instances where activists were sharing ideas and mobilization techniques that they learned in these protests.
So lots of seeds being laid in the decade before this. But was there another event that sort of got things going besides the death of this young man? Was it Tunisia? Was it rumblings elsewhere? What was it?
I think Tunisia played a huge role because I think it became clear to people that because these uprisings are unpredictable, that is, the people who are participating in them, they don't know that they're going to be in the street tomorrow because their calculation is, will it be effective or not? Will I face the security forces or not? And so once it started happening in Tunisia, people in Egypt thought, well, if Tunisia, which is much smaller than Egypt, can do it, where we've been protesting for a long time, we know how to do it, what if we could actually reach this tipping point? So it's an interesting thing, right? People don't know the tipping point is coming. They can't predict it will, but they just saw it happen next door. So Tunisia was huge.
Well, and you also write that even though these seeds perhaps were planted in the decade leading up to the Tahrir Square protests, they were still a surprise
to everybody,
even the people who were participating.
Absolutely. In fact, the activists who organized some of the first demonstrations, whether they were in Tahrir Square in Cairo or whether they were in Suez or Alexandria or Ismailia, they were all surprised that people started coming into the streets. And that's where the response of the regime really makes a difference. So many people felt that the Mubarak regime didn't take seriously what was coming, and they didn't respond in a way that people found compelling or convincing. And when the regime allowed these kind of thugs to sort of attack the protesters in Tahrir and elsewhere, actually, there was many kind of street battles in other cities that didn't get as much coverage, then actually that generated more sympathy for the protesters. So there's a lot of response that the governments can do to either sort of accommodate dissent or actually escalate it. In the Egyptian case, almost every decision the Mubarak government made in the early days of January and February actually reinforced the commitment of many ordinary Egyptians to go to the streets who had never been to the streets before. Never.
What surprised me and the headline I kept waiting for, which luckily didn't happen, Jeannie, was I kept waiting for the military to just open fire on these folks.
And that's the huge difference, of course, between Egypt and Tunisia and then many other cases, especially, of course, Syria. And if we think about just the tragedy that's playing out in Syria, the only reason it's different in Egypt and Tunisia is the militaries early on said, we will not stand by the regime. And it's because the militaries are highly institutionalized and their survival is not dependent on the survival of Mubarak or of Ben Ali in Tunisia. They're a sort of coherent organization that can actually survive the fall of different regimes.
That's interesting.
And in Syria, it's exactly the opposite case, because the Assad family over the last decades staffed the security apparatus and the sort of military with its own. They know they will go down.
All right. Well, more conversation after a short break, and we'll take your phone calls at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. We're looking at the future of Egypt today in The Exchange and The Journey to Tahrir, a new book of essays on the political transformation in that country. And we'll be right back.
Good morning. It's 9:19. You're listening to NHPR. Join Kate McNally for the next installment of the Tupelo Public Radio Project. Kate will be on stage with Chris Smither for an evening of music and talk. They'll be at the Tupelo Music Hall in White River Junction, Vermont, on July 21st. For tickets and information, visit nhpr.org. Support for NHPR comes from you, our members, and from Heritage Plumbing Heating Cooling, offering tune-ups, repairs, and efficient air conditioning systems, including ductless AC for homes without ductwork. Online at justcallheritage.com. And from UNH Continuing Education, announcing fall registration opening July 25th, with classes beginning August 27th. Information at learn.unh.edu. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're talking with UNH professor Jeannie Sowers about the new book she co-edited. It's called The Journey to Tahrir, Revolution, Protest, and Social Change in Egypt. Let's hear from you. Based on what you've heard in the news recently, do you feel hopeful about Egypt's future or concerned that real change has not occurred? Also, if you have personal experience with the country, you're either from Egypt or you travel there often, what are your hopes and fears for that nation? Our number for you to join us with your questions and comments is 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post your comments on our Facebook page. And Jeannie, before we go to our listeners, you know, let's talk a little bit about the book itself. The protests were very well covered by many media outlets, including NPR. NPR listeners got a lot of information on these protests daily. So what new light do the essays in this book shed on those tumultuous weeks when Tahrir Square was really the top of the headlines?
I think the first thing they show is that it wasn't just Tahrir Square. If it hadn't been a countrywide uprising, it would have been put down. Because, again, if the security forces were very good about putting down one revolt at a time, but the fact that actually it was in provincial cities that don't get a lot of media coverage, where there was actually head-on clashes with the security forces, is what forced the security forces themselves to realize they had something extraordinary on their hands that they had never seen before. There's some very interesting interviews that several of the sort of heads of security did in Egypt after Mubarak was toppled, and they talked about how, for the first time, they realized they weren't going to be able to control the cities. So the geographic distribution really mattered, that it was a lot of places, not just one. The book covers, I think, that very well. The second thing that it covers is to sort of talk about how people protested. So one of my favorite chapters is by a professor of Arabic literature, Elliot Kola, where he talks about how do people actually stay in the streets. So this was, people have now protested for over almost a year and a half, and they do it in 100-degree heat. They do it in sort of conditions that are very difficult. And he talks about how the people who keep them by sort of through chants and slogans draw on whole repertoires of sort of cultural protest. So slogans that call sort of call together sort of people's sense of patriotism and nationalism and sort of sense of common purpose. And that's one thing when you talk to ordinary Egyptians, what was it like to go into the square of whatever street? They talk about feeling so proud that they were an Egyptian, that before they sort of felt embarrassed almost. Or why
embarrassed?
Why are we stuck with this regime that is so ossified? And in fact, a good example of this kind of feeling of we're not sort of living up to our potential was when we were there. We were there for the election of now President Obama. And people kept coming up to us and saying, congratulations on your election. Not congratulations on the outcome, but that you had an election. And so many people would say to me, just in the streets, why can you have an election and we can't? You know, we could have them. And so I think this, again, this kind of sense of collective empowerment is really unusual. And the book really well chronicles that evolution.
Well, and a little bit more on that, if we could. You know, I have wondered how you keep the momentum going. Those protests mm-hmm. lasted for days, even weeks. And mm-hmm. I started to think, okay, don't people have to go back to their jobs mm-hmm. and shopping for groceries mm-hmm. and, you mm-hmm. know, paying their taxes? I mean, how did people find the energy and the wherewithal to keep coming back day after day after day?
Well, I think that's, first of all, there's a lot of different groups protesting. So not everyone goes to the street all the time. The second is that someone does the childcare and the cooking and the shopping. And so many families divvy up the labor. I had many of my women friends who were kind of like, well, the men get to go to the square today and I can only go every other Friday because I'm working. And many women do go and protest. So the notion that somehow there's only men in the squares is not correct. But I think it does take a toll. And I think people are tired now. They're exhausted and they're worried. So the volume of the protest itself, of course, is going to go down over time. Now what you see is more organized political groupings calling specific protests so that specific groups go to the squares.
Our number again here on The Exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. And Jeannie, you said now the protests have become more organized. Groups are organizing different events. Let's talk about one of the biggest groups, and that's the Muslim Brotherhood. Under Mubarak, they were the target of political repression. Now, as you said, the country's new president comes from the Muslim Brotherhood. First of all, just how stunning a turn of events is this? I think the new president was arrested at one point for his political activities.
He was. Most of the leaders of the Muslim Brotherhood have spent time in jail. And that's not unusual for the Middle East and North Africa. What's fascinating about the Brotherhood is they've been in the Egyptian political sphere since the late 1920s. They developed out of the Suez Canal city of Ismailia. A school teacher, Hassan al-Banna, founded the movement. And from its beginning, it was kind of an interesting movement. It was against the British presence in the Suez Canal zone. And as such, they took part in a lot of sort of nationalist protest against the British. So they've had a long role in Egyptian political life. During the 1990s and 2000s, when the Mubarak regime started allowing at least the pretense of multi-party elections, the Muslim Brotherhood ran candidates as independents. So I, as an individual, could say I'm running for a seat. I couldn't say I was a member of the Brotherhood because it was a banned political organization. But people, of course, in local districts know. And so they actually had the largest single block of parliamentarians after the 2005 elections.
Even though they couldn't be named as such.
Exactly.
Exactly. So go ahead.
So they have an experience in being in Parliament. And one of the fascinating chapters done by two of my colleagues, Samer Shahata and and Joshua Stocker, talks about how in Parliament they took their job quite seriously. And they actually focused on issues that were of concern to ordinary Egyptians. And they didn't press a radical Islamic agenda because they knew that in the next election that's not going to get them reelected. So we have some sense of how the Muslim Brotherhood acts as a sort of pragmatic political force, because elections force you to deliver something.
Well, and I have a couple more questions about the Muslim Brotherhood for you, Jeannie. But let's go to our listeners now. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. And Bruce is calling first from Bristol. Hi, Bruce. Thanks for joining us. Go ahead.
Hi, good morning. I wonder if your guest could talk a little bit about the shift in diplomatic relations with Egypt, and particularly military-to-military relations. Mubarak was our strong ally in the region for 20 or 30 years, and it seems like an awful big sidestep or reversal.
Yeah.
Just talk about that.
It's a great question, Bruce, and one that definitely came up during the uprising, and it's still coming up now, so thank you. Go ahead, Jeannie.
It is a great question, Bruce, and I think that the U.S. administration is actually handling this quite well, in the sense that they're simply talking to whoever gets elected. And that's really all that they can do. I think the U.S. probably supported Mubarak long after it was actually in their interest to do so. And we can talk about that, about why that might be the case. I am a little less pessimistic about the future of U.S.-Egyptian relations, because I don't think that the past actually was such a great deal for Egypt, nor for the United States, to be honest, because it allowed the festering of conflicts like the Israeli-Palestinian conflict that really have worked to the detriment of the United States and of Israel and of Egypt. I think the Muslim Brotherhood will as already actually you can see in the public statements of Morsi, most Egyptians don't want a war with Egypt, with Israel. So I think that we can rule out that possibility, unless, of course, there's war by accident, which has certainly happened. But many Egyptians remember the wars with Israel, and they know that, first of all, they will lose, and second of all, it will further devastate their economy. But what you will see, and you're already starting to see it, is sort of a public renegotiation of the terms of the U.S.-Egyptian alliance. And that those terms, over time, are going to come to represent more of what ordinary Egyptians feel should be their foreign policy. And that's what's been lacking under the Mubarak regime. There was a huge disconnect between what the regime was doing and what ordinary Egyptians would have liked to see.
And it didn't make the United States look good to be good buddies with this terrible dictator.
Right. That's exactly right. But I think that most Egyptians are not somehow anti-American. They recognize that the sort of their own regime was repressive and was ineffective, and that they don't ascribe to somehow the United States.
Really? They're not still angry that we cozied up to Mubarak for so long?
Well, I think they're more concerned by other U.S. foreign policies as well. But again, most Egyptians worry about domestic politics, just like most Americans worry about domestic politics.
Didn't Secretary of State Hillary Clinton recently sit down with the new president?
Mm-hmm. She did. She did.
And was that big news? Did anything come of that?
Well, I think it's perfectly reasonable for the Secretary of State to go and visit the new president. And I think the questions that arose from that were this small sort of party of demonstrators. And that was actually a fascinating intersection of American politics being transferred abroad.
That's right. There were some protests. I think her limousine was pelted with tomatoes, I think I read.
Yes,
go ahead, Jeannie.
Yes, something. But that was actually a rumor that had been started on several websites in the United States, that the U.S. is supporting the Muslim Brotherhood, which is hugely ironic after supporting the Mubarak regime while it repressed the Muslim Brotherhood for three decades. But it was a very interesting example of how basically anti-Muslim Brotherhood propaganda or anti-Islamic propaganda generated in the United States actually has effects elsewhere, in this case in how these kind of pro-regime groups in Egypt were then blaming the U.S. for the success of the Muslim Brotherhood, which is, it's beyond unbelievable. So,
well, Bruce, thanks for the call. And you can join us, too, at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Again, the number for you to join us with your questions or comments or thoughts about recent events in Egypt, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. One more question about the Muslim Brotherhood. As the protests in Tahrir Square were, just generating headlines every single night, and it was such an exciting story to watch unfold, we here on The Exchange had a panel of Egyptians, people of Egyptian descent, who are living in the Granite State now. And to a person, they were worried about the Muslim Brotherhood. Several of them were Coptic Christians, worried that their interests would not be represented at best, worried that they might face repression at worst. What do you think about those fears?
I think they're very well founded. And one interesting section of this book actually talks about how under the Mubarak regime, there was a sort of state policy of discrimination against Coptic Christians. And there was also a state policy of supporting all sorts of Islamic groups as a counterweight to what we think of as the left, that is workers or political parties, liberal secular parties. And in fact, when Sadat came to power, he deliberately allowed and fostered the whole array of Islamic movements because he was worried about the remnants of the 1960s left. So the government has never sort of been straightforward about its policies on Coptic Christians. That being said, if you can keep a competitive electoral system and the Copts start to vote as they did recently, start to try to organize as a political bloc, they are a significant part of the electorate. And so as you can see already, the Muslim Brotherhood is making conciliatory statements about the relations with women and Copts. You know, whether those pan out, it's unclear. But right now, there has been, since the uprising began, and several chapters in the book chronicle this, an uprising in what we think of as sectarian conflict in sort of especially small villages, especially and as well as the cities of Alexandria and other cities. And those conflicts, again, have also been there, but they're often exacerbated. And what the authors argue in the book is that they're exacerbated by the government itself, because the government doesn't prosecute those who, say, set fire to a church. It doesn't have a sort of clear policy that, you know, you are sort of equal citizens before the state on certain things, noticeably the building of churches. Right now you have to get permission from the government. So those are issues that the new Egyptian government will have to deal with.
Our phone number again is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Our guest is Jeannie Sowers. She's a professor of political science at UNH and co-editor of the book we're talking about called The Journey to Tahrir: Revolution, Protest, and Social Change in Egypt. And Jeannie, I want to go back to what you said before, that even though these protests, this uprising that we saw in 2011, did come as a surprise to many people, yourself included, there were some seeds planted through the decade of the 2000s. One of those that you mentioned was the economy. And even though it looked really good on paper, the Egyptian economy seemed to be growing by leaps and bounds. Once you looked under the surface, it wasn't very good at all.
That's right. For the vast majority of Egyptians, they weren't getting the benefits of what we think of as trying to create markets and a more sort of vibrant private sector. And it's not just Egypt that had this happen. It was across many developing countries, all of them in the 1970s and 80s, because they're facing recurrent structural crises, mostly financial crises that look very similar to actually what's happening across Europe and the United States today. They actually had to embark on sort of scaling back government spending and sort of trying to liberalize prices. And all these economies in the 1950s and 60s experimented with sort of top-down industrialization. They looked at what the Soviet Union had accomplished, again, what it looked like it was accomplishing, and South Korea and all the Asian tigers, and they wanted to emulate this. So they expanded the role of the state in sort of promoting industrialization.
So big state industries. Go ahead.
Big state industries, exactly. And those became very inefficient over time, but also the Middle East is subject, of course, to a series of wars which destabilize all of the local economies. So they've had if you look at their economic situations, it's sort of stumbling from one crisis to another for several decades. And this had a huge impact on ordinary Egyptians. So their standard of living is not increasing very rapidly. And many people especially have to spend a large amount of money on food or fuel. But the revolution wasn't driven by poverty. It's really important to recognize that most of the young activists who helped organize this are actually middle class, by Egyptian standards, middle class, relatively well-educated, often underemployed youth. And so it's not a simple story where we had economic deprivation leading to uprisings. That being said, there's a huge amount of resentment against the kind of wealth accumulation that was happening as a result of these market reforms, because it accumulates to an interesting mix of existing state-owned enterprises, existing military and security forces that actually have huge stakes in the economy. So when we talk about a military-industrial complex, there is one in Egypt and the Middle East and North Africa, and they're very, very large. And they often benefit when you privatize or sell off assets, just as you can see in other countries. And we also had the rise of very influential family-held business groups that monopolized all sorts of markets, construction, steel, textiles. And so ordinary people saw that they were bearing the cost of economic reform, but they weren't really seeing the benefits. That's kind of the negative side of what happened. But there also is a positive side, which is a bit hard for us to document. But it's that there was more political space as a result of a sort of growing private sector that increased the sort of amount of expertise and financial resources that people could mobilize. And many of these kind of middle class, sort of youth in their 20s and 30s, actually work in small and medium enterprises. They work in a private sector. They're not dependent on the state in any way for their livelihoods. And so I think economic reform both punished large numbers of Egyptian, but also for especially the middle classes, it opened up new opportunities and it made them more able to engage in sort of concerted political action.
What's the unemployment rate in Egypt?
Well, the official unemployment rate is around, it's been around 10% for several decades up and down. But really, it's almost no one knows, but it's easily probably 20%.
Wow, it's a lot.
But we don't know. I mean, there's no really good accounting because, of course, Middle Eastern states didn't want to admit their true unemployment rates. It's highly destabilizing.
One more thing on the economy. I just couldn't help but note this, Jeannie, and this is from the opening chapter that you wrote. You talk about the banking sector and you say state and private banks alike increasingly cater to a small stratum of wealthy businessmen and state-owned enterprises. The costs of non-performing loans were shifted onto public finances when the state bailed out the banking sector and the stock market crashed in 1990 to 1991. Just sounding real familiar there, isn't it?
It is. And actually, that's drawing off of one of the fun chapters and very insightful chapters written by Professor Timothy Mitchell. He wrote a chapter in this book called Dreamland. And his basic point was that the financial crises there were sort of, in a way, a product of this system of crony capitalism that we saw. And I think what we see, whether it's in Spain or elsewhere, is that because we have a system of unregulated global finance, we're going to have these structural problems hitting countries one after the other until that particular system is fixed. Because you can bail out these countries over and over, but as soon as investors, sort of move to yet another country, it becomes the similar problem.
Okay, after a break, Jeannie, more calls and emails, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange at nhpr.org. Also, the exchange is on Facebook. You can go to our Facebook page, post your comments there. Coming up, I want to talk a little bit more about the role of social media in this Egyptian revolution, and we'll hear more from you, so stay with us.
2,000 dollars in Irving Oil Gas gift cards is just the early bird prize in NHPR's summer car raffle. You'll also have a chance to win a kayak from Portsmouth Kayak Adventures, a bike and a cargo rack for your car from S&W Sports, and the grand prize is your choice of a Ford Fusion or a Toyota Prius, donated in part by Grapponi Automotive Group. Raffle tickets are just $50 at 1-888-805-NHPR or nhpr.org.
Good morning. It's 9:39. You're listening to The Exchange on NHPR. Support for NHPR comes from you, our members, and from Goodwill Industries of Northern New England, reminding you that donations make a difference in people's lives. Details about the donate movement at goodwillnne.org/donate. And from the Wealth Management Group at Merrimack County Savings Bank, trust and wealth management services provided by advisors committed to your financial needs. TheMerrimack.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Monday in The Exchange, the debate over New Hampshire's Great Bay and how best to protect it. Email us your thoughts at exchange@nhpr.org before the program, and then join us Monday morning live at 9. Today on The Exchange, Egypt's transformation over the past year and a half. A new book co-edited by our guest today, Jeannie Sowers, looks at the many factors involved, and we've been talking about those this hour. Let's hear from you, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. And Jeannie, let's go back to our listeners and go to Katie, calling in from Tufton Borough. Hi, Katie, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, and thank you, Professor Sowers, for your book and for participating on the show with this topic. I wanted to follow up on your comment about the young middle class who have gone into Tahrir or who led the revolution, I think that we tend to focus on sort of this Facebook revolution, the Twitter revolution, but often tend to forget that this was also a satellite TV revolution, that it was not just the middle class youth who were leading this revolution, but also those who came in from all economic classes and were protesting not only for freedom and dignity, but also for simply bread, and that it's important to remember those who participated, even if they were not leading the revolution as well. Thank you.
Katie, thank you very much for calling in. What do you think, Jeannie?
I think she's absolutely right. I think that was a wonderful comment. I just want to mention about the satellite revolution that there's a chapter in the book called Revolution and Counter-Revolution in the Egyptian Media, in which Ursula Lindsay, who is a Cairo-based media writer, actually takes on this issue of how important Al Jazeera was in giving coverage of the revolution to those participants. And you're absolutely right in that although there was a segment that's leading the protests, of course they wouldn't have been successful unless people from many other groups and sort of class strata got involved. So you're absolutely right. I think the demand about bread is a little more complicated, only in the sense, you're right, that was certainly one of the chants. It's certainly one of the sort of demands. But bread is actually, of course, highly subsidized in Egypt. And we get to sort of a crux of some of the problems that any Egyptian government will face. And this is, I think, one thing that comes out in the book, is that Egypt faces a set of structural economic difficulties that the Brotherhood and the military and many groups are going to have to deal with, which is that Egypt relies on imports of food. Those imports of food are highly subsidized. And yet ordinary Egyptians lack the purchasing power to actually make those purchases in many cases over time. So you're right, it is about bread. But the actual bread itself is also kind of an interesting story about government subsidies, the sort of global financial market for food, which is very, very high right now and has been intermittently, that has a very strong impact on developing countries like Egypt. And part of those very high prices are because the price of bread is set through global movement of commodities. And the only reason I want to make that link is we were just talking about the financial crisis. But if we think about how oil prices are set, or actually grain prices are set, those aren't set based on simply demand and supply. They're actually based on speculative movements of traders in futures markets, which we still call commodities markets, but they're actually sort of decisions about financial instruments. So yes, Egyptians are worried about the price of bread, but the price of bread is determined by all sorts of forces that the Egyptian government really doesn't have a lot of control over.
Well, and I read somewhere that, while the Americans love this storyline of the Facebook revolution, mm-hmm. the Twitter revolution, and so forth, I'm glad Katie called, because I have read that, yes, these social media tools of organization were important, but don't overstate their importance. Mm-hmm. It was the fact that people cared enough to show up, mm-hmm. stay there, and risk the consequences. That's what mattered the most.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think, though, it's interesting in the sense that what those technologies did, I think, was simply another form of very decentralized communication. And those can also take traditional forms. So people, when the cell phones were shut down during January and February, they turned to landlines. And more importantly, they simply turned to very densely sort of populated neighborhoods where you can actually convey information very quickly. So when the regime pulled off the police off the streets completely, they just took the security forces off the streets, every neighborhood organized local groups of people to sort of try to safeguard their neighborhoods. And these also served as forms of information. So I think Katie's exactly right. I think we tend to a little bit overstate the role of social media. But the ongoing organization of many of these activist groups continues using many of these social media tools. So they're not going away either.
Let's take another call if we could. And again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Katie, thank you for that one. Up next is Ryan calling in from New York City. Hi, Ryan. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Laura. Thanks for taking my call. I actually grew up in New Hampshire, and Jeannie was a professor of mine 7 years ago at UNH.
Oh, that's so great. Thanks for calling, Ryan. Go ahead.
Yeah, sure. My question is about the lesbian and gay and transgendered populations in Egypt. I know that they suffered tremendously under the hands of Mubarak's regime, and I'm wondering how they might expect their lives and their rights to change under the new government.
Ryan, it's a great question. Thank you very much. Go ahead, Jeannie.
Thank you, Ryan. And of course, I remember you extremely well. So it's great to hear your voice. There is a chapter, I mean, I'm not trying to be self-referential about this book, but a wonderful activist, Hussein Bahget, who is leading one of the most interesting human rights organizations in Egypt, wrote a chapter in this book. It's called Explaining Egypt's Targeting of Gays. And under the Mubarak regime, as you know, there was this arbitrary sort of enforcement of criminalization of being gay or lesbian or transgender. And unfortunately, I don't think that you're going to see that sort of contentious cultural politics resolve anytime soon in a way that's going to be sort of respectful of people's sort of private choices. I think because the Muslim Brotherhood has a sort of cultural, a conservative cultural agenda, if you like, that actually I would be sort of a bit pessimistic for the sort of for, you know, the short term about seeing any sort of legitimation of kind of those choices. I think there can be a fairly widespread tolerance of private behavior, but we'll have to see. And so I wish I had better news on that front.
Well, Ryan, good to hear from you. And here's an email from Ben who says, has the Brotherhood's conservative views on women helped or hurt them in Egyptian politics?
It's an interesting phrasing because I'm not sure that most Egyptians are voting on the basis of women's rights. I wish they actually were, but I don't think
they are. But there were women out there in the square and so forth.
Oh, absolutely. I think that we tend, again, when we're talking about Egyptian politics, if we focus too much on the Brotherhood, we forget some huge, important political trends. One is that there's a group of Islamic organizations that are far more conservative and, I would actually say, in some ways, reactionary, the Salafi movements, who have much more sort of rigid views about women's participation in political life or public life. And then we have a huge amount of the electorate which actually is more concerned, which, as Katie said, which kind of fundamental economic issues and political rights. But then we also have many Egyptians who say, well, I am a practicing Muslim, and I think that, you know, the culture around me is predominantly Muslim, and I'm happy and happy about that, but that I don't actually think it has any place in political life. And if you look at the first round of the presidential election, it was almost the best indicator of how diverse the Egyptian electorate actually is looking, which is that a third of, let's just be very rough about the numbers, but a third approximately voted for Ahmed Shafiq, who was this former regime. He was the last, one of the last prime ministers under Mubarak, but he was basically an Air Force general. And then we have, of course, Mohamed Morsi. But we actually had these other more interesting candidates, a progressive, several progressives, and together they actually took about a third of the vote. So the Muslim Brotherhood is not monolithic. It's not uniformly supported. And it's going to have to actually tack to the center in order to stay relevant in Egyptian politics. And that's why they've started issuing these very public statements about women and about the Coptic Christians, because they cannot ignore these sort of other forces that are at play.
Well, Ben, thanks for the email. The email address again, exchange@nhpr.org. The number, 1-800-892-6477. And Doug is joining us from Nashua. Hi, Doug. Thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Oh, sure. Thanks for the program.
Sure.
I can relate to the Egyptian people definitely wanting, earlier in the show, your guest had mentioned about their just thanking us for an election and that they just want a chance to vote. And, you know, I could sympathize with that. I do definitely have concerns about the Muslim Brotherhood, though. I was reading recently Itamar Marcus, who ends up, I think, as Palestinian Media Watch, and it may have been in the Jerusalem Post, too. After the election, of course, elected president, one of the leaders, if not the leader of the Muslim Brotherhood, was in one of their squares there, and I'm not sure the name of it, but with thousands of people there, and he was chanting millions of martyrs for Jerusalem. And he said, Jerusalem will be the capital of a new caliphate in the Mideast. And the people were chanting with him. So, you know, that's a real, real concern, and that's my concern, is if they get into power, they're just going to say what they want now, but then once they're really in, you know, they're just going to be another real serious threat.
Hamas or something like that. You know, what do you think about this? It's concerning what Doug says.
I actually think that his sources are incredibly revealing. So, for those of us who have long tracked Israeli politics, I did work. My first work in the Middle East was actually in an Israeli-Palestinian community, an intentional community that was for coexistence. And the sources that he cites have a very strong agenda in the Middle East. And it's essentially a sort of one in which the fear of the Muslim Brotherhood is then used for a whole host of political purposes. So the first thing is I'd call attention to your sources, and I'd actually say that it's unlikely that the story is accurate. That's the first thing. The second thing is that random people will say random things in any political system. And the important thing is what they say. People will do what they say in public most of the time. And so far, there's no indication that the new president of Egypt is making those statements in any public forum that I have heard. The other thing is that I think this is, again, where American politics is obscuring our view of the Middle East and of Egypt. In other words, Egyptians aren't as obsessed as we are with the fear of the Brotherhood. And again, the Brotherhood is only one of many organizations, and it will have to negotiate and bargain and accommodate and compromise as long as we have this system of laws and institutions in place. And in Egypt, there's no sign that anyone wants to overturn the role of those laws in setting the rules of the game. The sort of bargaining that we see right now is to shape the content of the rules without throwing out the rule book. And that's hugely important. It's what makes the Egyptian uprising look very different than the aftermath of the Iranian Revolution. Because in the Iranian Revolution, you actually threw out the rule book, you threw out the regime, but you also overturned the existing social order. And that's simply not on the table for Egypt. And the best thing the United States can do is, frankly, what the administration is actually doing, which is constructively deal with new political forces, because they're going to change quite rapidly to accommodate to their very uncertain sort of political context.
Here's what I'm wondering, Jeannie.
Yeah.
People hear Islamist Party, Muslim Brotherhood, they think Taliban. And Egypt's just, you know, watch out. Mm-hmm. What do you think?
I think the Taliban are the exceptional ones, actually. The Muslim Brotherhood is in most, or similar parties are in most regimes in the Middle East. And I think it's rather ironic that we get worried about sort of groups that are coming into power based on a kind of broadly religious appeal.
Because it's hard for us to relate to in this society.
But it shouldn't be. It shouldn't be. We just had an election, which we had sort of rise of the Tea Party within the Republican Party, which objectively draws many of its organizing sort of stories and resources from the evangelical Christian community. So our notion, our self-image about ourselves, is that religion doesn't matter in politics, but it matters hugely. And the groups that are organizing in the U.S. and put out these notions that groups like the Brotherhood are, say, active in the United States, which is simply empirically not the case, also are tied into political movements in the United States. So I think I have no more suspicion of the Muslim Brotherhood than I do other religiously motivated groups that engage in politics, which is that do we agree with all of their social values? Absolutely not. But that's the point of trying to construct civic states. And the slogan of many Egyptians was many of them want to create this or to live in this, what they call a civic state. They don't call it a secular state because they believe that they are religious, but they call it a civic state. Whether they'll be successful, we don't know yet. But it's the likelihood is that's what they've had for a very long time. And it's going to be very difficult. And most people don't want to dismantle those institutions.
There's one more group we haven't talked about yet, Jeannie. And I want to ask you about it, even though we're getting close to the end, because it's the subject of your forthcoming book about environmental politics in Egypt. Boy, when I looked at the journey in Tahrir, I thought I didn't even know Egypt had an environmental movement. But you write that there's a small but sometimes effective environmental movement in Egypt. Who are they? What role do they play in this transition?
Well, the book actually looks, the one that's forthcoming, looks at all sorts of environmental issues, not just as social movements. So states in the Middle East and North Africa are actually gravely concerned with some kinds of environmental problems that are actually a big threat to them. And a lot of conflict that we see as political or economic has to do with, especially in developing countries, also issues of land, access to land,
water,
land use, and absolutely, and water. And so what I look at is sort of attempts to sort of restructure access to natural resources by all sorts of groups, whether they're groups of experts trying to sort of reform an irrigation system, or they're groups of activists trying to sort of make more inclusionary sort of sets of access. And since the revolution, what's absolutely fascinating is, again, if we think in terms of sort of empowerment of all sorts of groups, and this is why, again, our focus on the Muslim Brotherhood detracts us from the full sort of array of groups that are making claims on the Egyptian president. Let me give you a really fascinating example. So in the past couple of weeks, since Morsi took the, he actually moved into the presidential palaces, there's been all these protesters sitting outside the actual presidential grounds, making all sorts of demands. So again, groups feel that they can now articulate their demands outside the palace. Under Mubarak, they would have been cleared in an instant by baton-wielding right. security forces who would have never tolerated this. So the fact that, you know, mothers are sitting demanding to see their sons in prison, or again, Nubians are saying, we want land in Lake Nasser, tells us something about how Egyptian politics has changed at this local level. And what the book, the sort of the 22 authors in this book are the vast majority of Egyptian political scientists, sociologists, and anthropologists who write. They're not all Egyptian. I mean, many are in America. But all of them had this interest in looking at all these layers of politics because we only focused on the elite and people kept saying Mubarak, Mubarak, we didn't think about all these other people who now actually matter a lot. And that was revolutionary about the uprising.
All right. Well, Jeannie, it's been great to talk to you. Thank you so much. And we appreciate your time.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure to be here.
Jeannie Sowers, Associate Professor of Political Science at UNH, co-editor of the book we talked about, The Journey to Tahrir, Revolution, Protest, and Social Change in Egypt. Jeannie's forthcoming book is called Activists, Experts, and the State. It's focused on environmental politics in Egypt. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our intern is Samantha Johnson. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange is now on Facebook. Become a fan of our Facebook page, where you can learn more about upcoming shows and get extra links and material. Our executive producer is Keith Shields, and I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
Next week on The Exchange, we sit down with one of the biggest players in New Hampshire politics this year, Republican House Speaker Bill O'Brien, on what he feels his party accomplished and some of the session's controversies. Then the following day, House Democratic leader Terry Norelli joins us. And later in the week, we kick off our coverage of the New Hampshire gubernatorial primary with Democrat Maggie Hassan. Email us at nhpr.org and join us all next week for The Exchange, each morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. here on NHPR.
The Diane Rehm Show is next on NHPR, where support comes from you, our members.